Welcome. This is Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story comes from NAU's The Lumberjack. Stepping into the spotlight, understanding the Two-Spirit Revival through Indigenous Drag by Taylor McCormick. Fresh to Flagstaff's drag scene is 20-year-old Angel Lust, a queen who boldly presents a hyper-feminized version of themselves. Her persona takes inspiration from car models in magazines she admired as a child. I was always interested in feminine things, Angel Lust said. Since being on the reservation, I didn't know you could do that until I saw a drag queen, and I was like, I can wear dresses. I started dressing up in my room secretly. Angel Lust is a gender-fluid Diné individual who uses all pronouns. When in drag, her outfits closely resemble the theme of each show she performs at. Her goal is to appear as a cisgender woman using long hair and revealing clothing to do so. There are no beauty or makeup stores on the Navajo Nation. When they visited Flagstaff as a child, they would sneak to the store to purchase whatever makeup they could get their hands on. During high school, they began watching RuPaul's Drag Race, and the first queen they were inspired by was Bianca Del Rio, a Cuban Honduran. In an interview with Refinery 29, Del Rio said she was told she was not Hispanic enough to represent her culture after winning the show's sixth season. Angel Lust said drag became a way for her to present the femininity she felt since eighth grade. Their outward appearance fluctuates based on how masculine or feminine they feel on a given day, and they believe Two-Spirit is part of this identity. Angel Lust said it can be hard to leave the reservation, a challenge they faced when they started their drag career. With limited Indigenous representation in the media, from drag queens to actors, they said they were unaware of the possibilities for different lifestyle choices. Angel Lust made her debut in March 2024 at Fresh Faces of Flaunt and was a special guest for the Give Back drag show at Yucca North during Indigenous Heritage Month. Now she is a new cast member for Dragstaff and performs the last Friday of each month at Fire Creek Coffee. She also became a member of the Kiki Scenes Phoenix-based House of Kittens in December of 2024. The Kiki Scene, created in the early 2000s by former Hedrick Martin Institute, HMI, staff members, provides an alternative to the mainstream ballroom scene for queer youth of color. The HMI serves as a LGBTQ+ youth services center. During Y2K night on February 28th at Fire Creek Coffee, Angel Lust performed twice. From floor work to climbing on tables, she confidently interacted with the crowd. They said the most difficult parts of getting ready to perform are the uncomfortable padding and high heels, though they have become more accustomed to the latter. At Revel's Drag Race, Angel Lust participated in a three-part competition with runway, talent, and question segments at the Monte Vista Hotel on February 14. She wore a Diné-inspired turquoise and orange dress with a feathered headdress, face paint, and red handprints on her neck. They recall the handprints made of grease paint and red lipstick stained their neck for a week. The red handprints are a symbol of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous People movement, a terrifying reality for many Native American women and girls. She used the competition as an opportunity to highlight the movement. Although she did not win, she said first place would have meant being a representative and a voice for Indigenous people. While they do not usually perform drag with undertones of advocacy, Angel Lust said Jade Justice, a Mexican-American queen who uses their platform for activism, encourages them to speak up. She's one of my really good friends, Angel Lust said. She brings a lot of her views and what's going on into the shows, and I really respect that about her. I feel like as drag queens, we are looked at more when you're at the shows. Between performances at Burlesque on Birch on February 22nd, a show at Hops on Birch, Jade Justice spoke to the crowd about the Trump administration. She said she is pained to see students turn on their classmates by threatening to report them and their parents to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement as a Mexican American. She followed up by encouraging the audience to protest anti-trans legislation. "Go do the damn thing," Jade Justice said. "If you have the ability to boycott, boycott with us." Angel Lust said attendees come to the shows to see drag, so the larger the turnout, the more they will hear about what is going on in the world, especially topics that affect LGBTQ plus individuals. Angel Lust plans to compete in Phoenix for the title of Miss Junior Phoenix Pride, as it is the first year the contest will be open to all of Arizona. She will also make an additional 10 sponsored appearances at drag shows in the Valley this year. The personas created by drag queens are nothing short of carefully curated. Dressed in a color-coordinated outfit and listening to 2000s pop music, Anastasia's persona only comes out once the wig and makeup are fully on, embodying her soft but sassy energy. Anastasia is a 31-year-old Dene Hopi and Taos drag queen who uses all pronouns and has been doing drag since 2012. She was introduced to drag after attending Flagstaff Pride the same year they came out, sparking her interest in dressing up glamorously. In her bright pink wig and big tutu, Halloween-era Anastasia would attend People Respecting Individuals and Sexual Minorities, PRISM, drag shows at NAU before her 21st birthday. Despite not identifying with labels, though they know a spectrum of identities exist, Anastasia said they feel a connection to the two-spirit identity. They view two-spirit the same way the LGBTQ plus community views gender-fluid identities, as an individual's gender presentation changes depending on how they feel that day. Anastasia said they became secure in their identity after shifting their views of gender, allowing them to feel confident both in and out of drag. "I just kind of went with it, or whatever somebody referred to me as," Anastasia said. "I'm still me at the end of the day. You're not going to hold something over me, but I am going to take what you've given me and still hold the power at the end of the day." On the reservation, Anastasia said she noticed minimal drag representation, but encountered transgender Indigenous individuals. When she hit her 20s, Anastasia learned about two-spirit identities and the Indigenous version of the gender spectrum. Subconsciously, she did not view gender expression and sexuality as black and white, but rather as people presenting as they truly are. "I'm just seeing somebody, I'm going to embrace whoever, and I feel like that's what Indigenous cultures have all kind of built upon," Anastasia said. "You just love and accept everybody. That's called kinship. Kinship is the main thing that keeps everyone together." Anastasia started drag around the same time as Anya C. Mann, a local Dene drag queen whom she admired. She said Mann is her RuPaul, and compared the way drag queens look up to him to the respect she has for Mann. Mann has been viewed as a mother figure for Flagstaff drag queens after receiving recognition and awards for her art. In addition to Mann, Anastasia enjoys watching every drag staff artist perform because it gives her ideas for song choices she would not have considered otherwise. "They believe as a drag queen they will always make a political statement just by leaving the house." Anastasia said it was rewarding when they realized being confident in their own identity can inspire others. Anastasia was inspired by celebrities like Britney Spears and Lady Gaga for being outspoken and confidently expressing themselves regardless of criticism they received. Between the ages of 14 and 16, Anastasia lost both of her parents and hopes they are looking down at her, proud of her accomplishments. She said one piece of advice helped her persevere through hardships and pushed her to always accept herself. "Be happy, be proud, be you." "Even on a bad day," Anastasia said, "if you can find one thing you're happy about, be proud that you got over it, and at the end of that bad day, you're just being yourself. That's all you can be." When getting ready for a show, 27-year-old Planet Cree finds herself rushing and stressing out. If something doesn't fit right, she will rip it out and scrap it from the look entirely. Planet Cree expresses her creativity by experimenting with drag she described as weird and different, much like her paintings and drawings. She grew up in the depths of the Grand Canyon alongside her tribe, the Havasupai, and she said drag is critical to conveying political messages. Drag inherently is pretty political, and especially recently, Planet Cree said. It kind of waxes and wanes with how controversial drag is to people. Planet Cree said she wants drag to become more political, considering her experience with national parks as a former junior ranger. She uses her social media platform on TikTok to bring awareness to environmental concerns within the Grand Canyon, in addition to misconceptions about indigenous people. There's issues going on with my tribe in the Grand Canyon, Planet Cree said. Now with their presidency, national parks are not being taken care of anymore. They're firing a bunch of park rangers and people who take care of nature. Planet Cree began doing drag about 2 years ago with the encouragement of drag queens Revolution and Glam Lad Cometh after coming back to Flagstaff to finish college. She remembers feeling nervous and shaky during her first performance. To remedy this, she views shows as a way to prove herself worthy of recognition as a drag queen. She is focused on ensuring she has a good time, inadvertently reflecting that energy back to the audience. She said her drag persona is a mixture of dumb, goofy, and campy looks with scary, dark aesthetics. She includes leather, black and red, into her makeup and outfits. Her goal is to be both freaky and funny at the same time. Planet Cree said society is usually shocked by her art form. She has created a few cultural outfits inspired by her identity as a Havasupai artist. Although Arizona's representation of indigenous drag is considerable, she believes there is minimal education on what it means to be a drag queen, especially within a variety of native ways of life. Everyone just has their own thing, their own religion, their own culture, Planet Cree said. I think it can be hard to appreciate other people's cultures sometimes, but I think it mostly comes from a lack of understanding. Planet Cree did not learn about the missing and murdered indigenous people movement until college. She was horrified. She is aware not everyone has met an indigenous person and may not know they still exist, but she said locals are lucky to live in Flagstaff where indigenous culture is visible. Realize that these people and artists are not your enemies, Planet Cree said. They're just people trying to cope with life, too, make art, and make people happy. Next story is related, The Beginning of Indigenous Drag Revival by Taylor McCormick for the NAU Lumberjack. Drag emerged in the late 19th century with the first recorded drag ball arising in Harlem, New York. The event allowed participants to express themselves creatively and play with gender identity through exaggerated features and mannerisms contradicting traditional gender expectations. While drag is open to anyone, ballroom in particular was created for Black and Latino queer individuals as a response to racism in queer spaces. Crystal LaBejia, a Black transgender woman, revived ballroom culture with the creation of the House System in 1968, which aided queer people of color in finding community through chosen families. She acted as a house mother to homeless LGBTQ youth. In 1990, several attendees at the 3rd Annual Intertribal Native American First Nations Gay and Lesbian American Conference in Winnipeg, Manitoba, introduced the term two-spirit, which refers to a person who embodies both masculine and feminine qualities. Two spirits are often visualized as two spirit-like intertwined entities outside the Western gender binary, though this can vary across tribes. In Diné, Dilba refers to a masculine woman or third gender. While not all Native drag queens are two-spirit, the identity has made its mark within Indigenous queer communities. Before bigotry caused by colonization, two-spirit individuals were well-trusted and respected by tribal members. They helped maintain cultural traditions as educators and medicine people and are well-known as knowledge keepers. The title made them targets, as colonization aimed to destroy closely guarded knowledge in Indigenous traditions and cultures. Despite efforts to diminish two-spirit identities and fluid gender expression, Indigenous drag has persevered. several native drag queens use their platforms to shed light on two-spirit existence and use their outfits and performances to pay homage to their tribes. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, Arizona advocates urge Governor Hobbs to block Oak Flat Mine Waste Facility on state land by Native News Online staff. Tribal advocates, conservation groups, faith leaders, and community organizers are calling on Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs to halt plans that would convert thousands of acres of state trust land into a massive dumping ground for mine waste tied to the proposed Resolution Copper Project. In a coordinated push, opponents urge the governor to prevent the auction and development of land in Dripping Springs Valley, identified as the site for a tailings storage facility that would hold nearly 1.4 billion tons of mining waste. The facility would support the proposed copper mine east of Phoenix, a project that would ultimately destroy Oak Flat, a site sacred to Native American communities. Governor Hobbs has the power to stop Arizona from being used as a dumping ground for toxic mine waste, and we need her to use it before it's too late. The governor can make sure our state isn't complicit in Oak Flat's destruction, said Russ McSpadden, Southwest conservation advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. These state lands are supposed to serve the public and future generations, not expose people and wild places to long-term risk. Arizonans deserve better. According to the U.S. Forest Service's final environmental impact statement, the proposed tailings facility, known as Skunk Camp, would span more than 9,200 acres, or roughly 14 square miles, making it one of the largest in the world. The site would store toxic mining byproducts containing heavy metals, such as lead and arsenic, held behind a dam rising nearly 500 feet. The Forest Service's own analysis says Skunk Camp tailings facility would harm people nearby, including tribal communities, and many lower-income rural and Latino communities in the region, said Henry Munoz, a retired underground miner and member of Retired Miners Concerned Citizens in Superior, Arizona. A tailings failure would contaminate the Gila River Basin all the way to Phoenix and hurt Arizonans and the environment for generations. Opponents also argue the plan conflicts with Arizona's legal obligations for managing state trust land. The Arizona State Land Department has determined the facility would reduce surrounding land values, raising concerns about whether the project serves the best interest of trust beneficiaries, including public schools. Arizonans would bear the environmental risk, water depletion, and long-term liability of this project, while foreign investors reap profits, the groups wrote in a letter to Hobbs. Your administration has the authority to protect Arizona families and preserve the integrity of state trust land by rejecting this dangerous mine tailings facility proposal. Arizona state trust lands are held in trust to generate long-term value for schools and other beneficiaries, and that responsibility requires careful, forward-looking stewardship, said Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter. Approving a massive toxic tailings facility that would devalue surrounding lands and create lasting environmental liability is incompatible with the State Land Department's fiduciary duty. State leaders have both the authority and obligation to ensure these lands are managed in a way that protects their value and avoids shifting long-term risks onto future generations, including school children who are trust beneficiaries. The controversy is closely tied to Oak Flat, a place of deep cultural and spiritual significance that is listed on the National Register of Historic Places as a traditional cultural property. The area remains central to the religious practices and identity of Western Apache and other tribal nations. Don't mine what can't be remade. Protect Oak Flat, said Selena Lamas, Acamel O'odham, a member of the Brophy Xavier Native American Club, Class of 2028. Some places are more than resources. They hold history, culture, and life that can't be replaced once they're gone. When land like this is destroyed, it isn't just nature that's lost, but a part of identity and legacy that future generations will never get back. Resolution Copper plans to use block cave mining to extract ore deep underground, a method expected to cause the surface at Oak Flat to collapse into a crater nearly 2 miles wide and more than 1,000 feet deep. The operation would also require significant groundwater pumping, enough critics say to supply the city of Tempe for decades, raising additional concerns about regional water availability. If approved, the project would transport billions of tons of waste through pipelines to the Skunk Camp site, transforming thousands of acres of state trust land into a long-term storage facility for toxic tailings, an outcome opponents say would have lasting consequences for communities, ecosystems, and future generations. Up next, in education, Oklahoma Governor Stitt calls Native Education Council redundant, moves to end it, by Levi Rickert, for Native News Online. Republican Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, a tribal citizen of the Cherokee Nation, has moved to eliminate the state's Native American Education Council, arguing the body is unnecessary and ineffective, a decision that is drawing concerns from tribal leaders and education advocates. Stitt recently issued a veto that could discontinue the council, describing it as redundant and criticizing its infrequent meeting schedule. The council, established to help improve educational outcomes for Native students and ensure tribal perspectives are included in state education policy, has served as a formal avenue for collaboration between tribal nations and state officials. The governor's office contends that the council duplicates efforts already underway within the Oklahoma State Department of Education and other entities, suggesting its responsibilities can be absorbed elsewhere. Stitt also pointed to the council's limited number of meetings as evidence that it is not fulfilling a meaningful role. But critics say the move overlooks the importance of dedicated tribal representation in education policymaking, especially in a state that is home to 39 federally recognized tribal nations. Advocates argue that the council provides a unique forum for addressing disparities that disproportionately affect Native students, including lower graduation rates, underfunded schools in tribal communities, and the need for culturally relevant curriculum. The council has also played a role in supporting Native language preservation efforts and advising on the implementation of tribal history and cultural standards in Oklahoma classrooms, an issue that has gained prominence in recent years. Opponents of the veto warn that eliminating the council could weaken government-to-government relationships between the state and tribal nations at a time when collaboration is increasingly important in areas like education, health, and economic development. They also note that infrequent meetings may reflect broader challenges, such as limited funding or administrative support, rather than a lack of need. The veto now places the future of the Native American Education Council in uncertainty, with lawmakers and the tribal leaders weighing next steps. Some are expected to push for an override or alternative measures to preserve a formal mechanism for tribal input in education policy. In our next story, the Indigenous Chefs That Inspire Food as Medicine on the latest Chopped episode, by Sean Griswold. On a New York City pier, Justin Pioche had a surprise run-in with a friend and fellow Native American chef, Ray Naranjo, that provided a major reveal. It wasn't a typical day for Pioche. The Navajo chef said he flew into the city and was directed to an undisclosed warehouse where he would be filmed as a competitor in a new episode of Chopped that premieres in April on the Food Network. "My buddy Ray comes walking around the corner while they're filming me," Pioche inquired. "What are you doing here?" Pioche finished the question to his friend from Santa Clara Pueblo, and the two Indigenous chefs instantly made the connection. "It clicked in both our heads. Oh, we're going against each other. So we just smiled and waved at each other, gave each other a hug, Piyush described. Then the producers were like, oh no, you're not supposed to be here. Ray, go over there, go over there. Chopped, the cooking competition show, has aired 64 seasons on the Food Network since 2009. For the first time this week, the showcase features indigenous food sovereignty as the main ingredient across an entire competition. Competitors include chefs from Navajo, Santa Clara Pueblo, Menominee, and Blackfeet Cherokee nations. Every basket is packaged with ingredients known and loved in Native communities, like sumac and whitefish for the first round. Food Network producers for the episode shared. The judges look forward to tasting entrees featuring a lean, tasty protein. There is a deeper prominence inspired from the episode that grows beyond the ingredients that the chefs used. Food has always been medicine, and I think we need to keep it that way because medicine can be more than just nourishment. It can be some sort of way to heal yourself, Piyush said. I mean, as natives, we all celebrate food. We all laugh around it. We cry. We celebrate. We mourn. It brings us together. Piyush, who runs Piyush Food Group with his sister and mother, shared a few details on how he approached competing on the show against familiar people from the tight-knit indigenous food sovereignty scene. Each of us has our own style. I was raised in fine dining, and so that's just always in the top of my head. So don't be afraid to push the envelope, but don't get too crazy. So that was my approach, to use somewhat familiar flavor profiles and also cooking procedures, he said. Naranjo set the tone about the significance that the chefs had to showcase their work in the kitchen and how it reflects their roles within indigenous communities. Ray got us all together beforehand, and we did a little pep talk, Piyush said. No matter who wins and no matter who loses, you got to always make sure that we use our voices for good and for our communities. We all agreed. There were no hard feelings whatsoever between any of us, whether we won or lost. In addition to Piyush and Naranjo, competitors included Jessica Walks First and Mariah Gladstone. You've been listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Remember, you can always hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot and smart home device. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.